Bhishma Dev, text number 36. Vyavahita pritana mukham niriksha. Svajana vadha vimukhasya dosha buddhya. Mati maharadatma vidyayaya. Charanarati paramasya tasya meshtu. Devahita pritana mukham niriksya. Svajana vadha vimukhasya dosha buddhya. Kumati maharad atma vidyayayas. Charanagati paramasya tasya mestu. Vyavahita pritana mukham niriksya. Svajana vadha vimukhasya dosha buddhya. Kumatim maharadatma vidyayayas. Charanarati paramasya tasme tasya meshtu. Word for word, please repeat Vyavahita. Standing at a distance. Pritana, soldiers. Mukham, faces. Nirikshya, by looking upon. Svajana, kinsmen. Vadhas, from the act of killing. Vimukhasya, one who is reluctant. Dosha buddhya, by polluted intelligence. Kumatim, poor fund of knowledge. Aharat, eradicated. Atma vidyaya, by transcendental knowledge. Yaha, he who. Charana, to the feet. Rati, attraction. Paramasya, of the Supreme. Tasya, for him. Me, my. Astu, let there be. Translation by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. When Arjun was seemingly polluted by ignorance, upon observing the soldiers and commanders before him on the battlefield, the Lord eradicated his ignorance by delivering transcendental knowledge. May his lotus feet always remain the object of my attraction. Purport. The kings and the commanders were to stand in the front of the fighting soldiers. That was the system of actual fighting. The kings and commanders were not so-called presidents or ministers of defense, as they are today. They would not stay home while the poor soldiers or mercenaries were fighting face to face. This may be the regulation of modern democracy, but when actual monarchy was prevailing, the monarchs were not cowards elected without consideration of qualification. As it was evident from the battlefield of Kurukshetra, all the executive heads of both parties, like Drona, Bhishma, Arjun and Duryodhana, were not sleeping. All of them were actual participants in the fighting, which was selected to be executed at a place away from the civil residential quarters. This means that the innocent citizens were immune from all effects of fighting between the rival royal parties. The citizens had no business in seeing what was going to happen during such fighting. They were to pay 1/4 of the income to the ruler, whether he be Arjun or Duryodhana. All the commanders of the parties on the battlefield of Kurukshetra were standing face to face, and Arjun saw them with great compassion and lamented that he was to kill his kinsmen on the battlefield for the sake of the empire. He was not at all afraid of the giant military phalanx presented by Duryodhana, but as a merciful devotee of the Lord, Renunciation of worldly things was natural for him, and thus he decided not to fight for worldly possessions. But this was due to a poor fund of knowledge, and therefore it is said here that his intelligence became polluted. His intelligence could not be polluted at any time because he was a devotee and constant companion of the Lord, as is clear in the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Apparently, Arjuna's intelligence became polluted because otherwise there would not have been a chance to deliver the teachings of Bhagavad Gita for the good of all polluted conditioned souls engaged in material bondage by the conception of the false material body. The Bhagavad Gita was delivered to the conditioned souls of the world to deliver them from the wrong conception of identifying the body with the soul and to re-establish the soul's eternal relation with the Supreme Lord. Atma Vidya, or transcendental knowledge of himself, was primarily spoken by the Lord for the benefit of all concerned in all parts of the universe. Om Ajnana Timilandasya Jnananjana Shlakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasati Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. So we are in this section of the ninth chapter where Bhishma Dev is offering prayers to his worshipful Lord Shri Krishna. So as we know that the Pandavas headed by Maharaj Yudhishthir and Lord Krishna and the great sages have assembled at the deathbed of Bhishma Dev, because Bhishma Dev had the mystic potency of being able to quit his body whenever he would like. So he found the time to be opportune, and Krishna arranged things that himself and all the Pandavas and all the great sages were there. So Bhishma Dev has just finished offering his instructions to Maharaj Yudhishthir on how to conduct the administrative affairs and other knowledge also. So now in the last few verses, Bhishma Dev is offering very wonderful prayers to his worshipful Lord Krishna, because Bhishma Dev had rasa with the Lord of chivalry. So he is remembering the Lord's chivalrous pastimes, specifically in relationship with Arjuna. So here it's mentioned that, in the previous verse it's mentioned that in obedience to the command of his friend, Lord Krishna entered the arena of the battlefield of Kurukshetra. So as we know, at the start of Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna requested his friend Krishna to drive the chariot in the midst of both the armies so that he can take account of who's on the opposing side. So Krishna did that, and here it's mentioned that actually Arjuna's intelligence was polluted by ignorance. And when Krishna drove the chariot in between the two armies, Arjuna took account of the soldiers and commanders on the opposing side. So in the purport, it's interesting, Srila Prabhupada, he compares the Vedic warfare to the modern day warfare. There's a sharp contrast we see. So one of the things which is very evident, what Srila Prabhupada brings up, is that the kings and the commanders would actually participate in the battle. And even the battle was fought for very different reason. These days, in the 19th century, there are over 45 wars which have taken place. And all these wars were basically fought for sense gratification. But in the Vedic times, the wars were fought, it was called Dharma Yuddha. In other words, yud means war, and dharma means a war which is fought for a righteous purpose. So because the kings were Rajarshis, in other words, they were saintly kings, their purpose in administration was to impart Krishna consciousness to their praja or to their dependents, and to create an environment which is favorable for executing Krishna consciousness. So they were basically managing protection. And if there was a threat to their dependents, there would be war. And war was, of course, a last resort. So even we see for the battle of Kurukshetra, so many means of were tried to avoid the war. It's mentioned Sama, Bheda, diplomacy, you know, offering gifts, sweet words, and when nothing worked, then war was the only option. But the point is, the kings back then were basically offering protection for the sake of having a peaceful environment where their dependents can execute Krishna consciousness and become a pure devotee. So these days also was a fought to offer protection, but the protection is basically to protect the Vaishyas, or in other words, to protect the economic interest of the country. So when so many wars are fought, it is to gain control over resources so the country can flourish economically. So the motives for war are very different. And in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 43rd verse of the 18th chapter, Krishna outlines the qualities of a Kshatriya. There he mentions that some of the qualities are heroism, power, determination, resourcefulness, courage in battle, generosity, and leadership. So these are the natural qualities by which the Kshatriyas function. So if we see the Kshatriyas of today's age, many of these qualities are lacking. And as Prabhupada mentions that the actual monarchy was prevailing, the monarchs were not cowards elected without consideration of qualification. So in other words, the soldiers and the commanders were selected based on their qualification. Whereas, of course, these days also, if you want to join the army, you have to be courageous. So some of these qualities still apply. For the officers, they're looking for those who can take a leadership role and lead their platoon or soldiers. They have to be determined. But in the Vedic age, especially we see the ministers, and they are not actually fighting on the battlefield. When there's a war, they're actually sitting at the back and pressing buttons. And it's the poor soldiers and mercenaries who are actually at the front. And the Vedic war was also, it was a fair war policy. In other words, equals would fight equals. So if we look at the battle of Kurukshetra, you would never see, you know, a superior fighting with an inferior. Equals would fight equals. So if someone's on a chariot, chariots would fight opposing chariots. A chariot would not fight the cavalry or the infantry. And so someone on an elephant would actually fight with someone on an elephant, not with an infantry soldier. And even we see in the Battle of Kurukshetra during the Mahabharata period, some of the soldiers had celestial weapons, divine weapons, which were given by demigods. We even know Arjuna, he was awarded with weapons from most of the demigods because Krishna was pleased with him. So therefore the demigods were also pleased with him, and they offered him their celestial weapons. So when Arjuna would fight, and then on the opposing side, if he would fire an arrow, then on the opposing side also, that soldier should possess celestial weapons. So therefore it's an equal fight. And in the Vedic warfare, there were no surprise attacks. Like these days you have guerrilla warfare. So guerrilla warfare is all about ambush and surprise attacks. It's a hit and run. You create a little bit damage and then you run away. And even build up of weapons and armies would be done with full knowledge of the opposing side. So unlike today's in today's defense systems, where this buildup of weapons is done very secretively. So back then they would actually know the opposing side. This is the strength of the army. And we also see if we read Mahabharata or even Krishna book, the battle would start at sunrise, not before sunrise, and it would end at sunset. So there was a time, okay, if battle is going to take place, it's between sunrise and sunset. And they'll fight in between that. And in the evening, both parties would, one party will go to the other party's camp, and then they will, have dinner together and talk and joke and appreciate each other's fighting abilities. So it's quite different to today's fighting. It's actually inconceivable. Very hard to conceive. And multiple warriors would not attack a single warrior. So today it's not like, today you have the naval forces, you have forces in the air, the missiles coming, and they're all attacking one object or one warrior. And even if two warriors are in a duel, then they have to possess the same weapons. And no one would be killed if they have surrendered. So if a soldier has surrendered or is injured, then that soldier would not be killed. So such were the rules. And if someone becomes a prisoner of war, then they'll be offered protection. So no warrior would kill or injure an unarmed warrior, and no one would kill or injure an unconscious warrior also. And no one would kill or injure a warrior whose back is turned away. So if soldiers were running, they would not kill them. And especially the lives of women, the prisoners of war, and farmers were considered to be sacred. So we can see this is a very sharp contrast to the modern warfare. So in the modern warfare, though there are rules of engagement, but they are nowhere near this. So battles take place anytime. And in modern warfare, we see who suffers the most, it is the civilians. So when there is warfare, so many civilians die, thousands and thousands. Like we see in Syria right now, there's a lot of political unrest, and the government is openly slaughtering the civilians. So we can see that the leaders actually don't care about the dependents. They just want to stay in power. And it's interesting, the civilians are killed for two reasons. One is, if they kill a large number of civilians, then the factories won't be able to function. So when the factories are not functioning, there cannot be economic development and weapons cannot be produced, which are needed in times of war. And when civilians are killed in large numbers, then the entire country gets demoralized. So, and as is mentioned in this purport, that in the Vedic warfare, the civilians had nothing to do with the war. They would just reside in the cities and towns and villages, and the war would be conducted in a remote area, and none of the citizens would be allowed to go there. All the citizens had to do was pay their tax, which is 1/4. So unlike in today's society, where even someone who is not working, he has to pay tax. So if we have to pay GST tax and so many other taxes, even if you're not working. So if you're working, you're paying 30% or 50% of your income as tax. And on top of that, there's so many other taxes. And when there is a war, then the government takes more money. So in the Vedic warfare, citizens would pay 1/4 of the income as tax, and they would, and the citizens had nothing to do with it. So whether it's Duryodhan or it's Arjuna, the king, they're not concerned. And in these days warfare, when there is war, the opposing side will destroy civilian infrastructure. So basically to cripple the government, to cripple the entire country. So of course these days warfare is so bad. You have biological warfare, you have chemical warfare, you have terrorism, counter-terrorism, there's propaganda warfare, psychological warfare, information warfare. So this is all very, you know, deceptive. And it's interesting, I was watching in the news that these days that even there are aircraft flying in the air, and in the planes their electronic systems are so advanced that they can, if there's a fighter jet in the vicinity, in the area, they can actually rewrite the software of that fighter jet sitting in the plane, and then they can cause that plane to crash. So these days warfare is not very, it's not fair, it's all unfair. By tricks and this and that they defeat. And one, as we see in Vedic warfare, the warfare was very subtle. It was gross also, but it was also subtle. Weapons would be fired, mantras would be invoked and weapons would be fired. So we see how Ashwatthama also, he invoked the Brahmastra weapon. And then that weapon was actually targeted in the womb of Uttara. It's not like a Tom Cruise missile or, which actually when it's, that's also targeted, but when it hits the target, everything in the area is destroyed. Whereas Brahmastra actually, you can even pinpoint it to a person. And it is possible even to retract it by the power of mantras. So here it's mentioned that Arjuna was seemingly polluted by ignorance. So Arjuna's ignorance is quite different to our ignorance. And in fact, ignorance is the deadliest type of pollution on the planet. So there's so many kinds of, there's environmental disasters. Recently, on the shores of America, one of the oil rigs, there was a blast on that and there was a big fire and so much oil leaked and there was a big pollution in the environment. And everyone was so concerned, there's this environmental pollution. But the biggest pollution is actually of ignorance. And this ignorance is caused because of forgetfulness of Krishna. So originally, all living entities in the material world were residing in the spiritual world. And because of this envy of Krishna, which leads to forgetfulness, and that leads to ignorance. And that's what actually causes us to be in the material world. So the example is given of how sometimes Prabhupada gives this example of how there's a child who is with his mother and is crying that he wants the moon. The child is crying, I want the moon. He can see the moon, but he wants it in his hand. And in order to pacify the child, the mother gives him a mirror. So when he holds the mirror, in the mirror he can see the reflection of the moon. So foolishly he thinks that, yes, I've got the moon in my hand. So in the same way, because of our rebellious attitude, Krishna actually has facilitated this material creation in order to facilitate this rebellious attitude of us, that we want to lord it over material, we want to lord it over, we want to have a position like Krishna. So Krishna puts us in the material world where we can think that we are the lord and master and the enjoyer and the proprietor. So for that reason the creation is actually takes place. And it's interesting, in the third canto it mentions that when Mahavishnu, he is lying down, and then he actually, when he's lying down and the material energy is dormant in him, he feels something lacking. He feels imperfect because his parts and parcels are actually sleeping in his body. So he feels imperfect, and then he creates the material world in order to give the conditioned souls a chance to fulfill their desires and to get frustrated and then eventually come back. So we know that when the material energy is unmanifested, it is called pradhan. So the material energy in its unmanifested state is pradhan, where all the elements, the three modes of nature, everything is there. The 24 elements are there in an unmanifested state. And when the Lord glances upon it, that glance contains the time potency and it contains the jivas. So time is the 25th element. And then pradhan manifests into prakriti and then into mahatattva. And then mahatattva originally is in pure goodness, but then it sooner changes into the mode of passion kicks in, then activities start, and then mahatattva is predominantly in the mode of, there is ignorance. And from that ignorance, the false ego is generated. And then false ego has, you know, false ego in the mode of goodness, passion and ignorance. So we can see also in the mahatattva there is this ignorance. And we know Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, he enters the universe and from his navel this lotus stem sprouts and there's a lotus flower on which Brahma is situated. And when Brahma begins the process of creation, the very first body he creates is actually of ignorance. So Brahma creates five kinds of ignorance. It's mentioned that the first one is called Tamisra. Tamisra means anger. So Prabhupada explains how it is this anger of the jiva that they actually want to enjoy like Krishna. They want to become one with Krishna. And then the second kind of ignorance is called Andha Tamisra, which means considering death to be the ultimate end. So in other words, when we die, that's it. So, you know, in other words, just enjoy as much as you can, and we're going to die anyway. And when we die, we're just going to be in the grave. So there's no sinful reactions, there's nothing. You just enjoy as much as you can. And that Andha Tamisra is actually caused by tamas. Tamas means lack of knowledge of the spirit soul. So Prabhupada explains, because this knowledge is lacking that we are the spirit soul, this ignorance is there, which causes Andha Tamisra ignorance. And then that further, the next type of ignorance is called Moha, in which one is infatuated by wealth, opulence, and the illusion of the bodily concept even increases more and more. And one is entrapped by the shackles of sex life. And then one lives in terms of me and mine. And then further on there is Mahamoha. So that illusion or ignorance is even further increased. So in this way, Brahma actually created this body. The first body was ignorance. The five kinds of ignorance was created. And when he created, he immediately shed off that body. And the Yakshasas and Rakshasas, it took the form of night and they embraced it. So of course, no one likes to be called ignorant. So in the material world, all the living entities are in a state of ignorance. Even when we take birth, we are in ignorance. It's described the process of childbirth is described in the Srimad Bhagavatam, how the living entity takes birth. And if the jiva is fortunate, he actually, the fortunate living entity recites prayers in the womb. He realizes his pitiable condition and he recites wonderful prayers to the Lord. But even sometimes then, even when the living entity comes out of the womb, he falls under ignorance. Because everyone in the material world is in ignorance, so then it seems like it is normal. So actually no one likes to be called ignorant. If we call someone, tell someone you're ignorant, they will take that as an offense. Of course these days people will say, yeah, everyone else is ignorant, the world is so ignorant, the way people are living, they're destroying the environment, things are so corrupt, there's so much ignorance. But it is very hard for people to accept that they themselves are in ignorance. And everyone, ignorance means they actually think they know everything. So this, because of ignorance, it generates this pride in which one thinks that he or she is in full control of their life and they know everything. So under ignorance, people, yes, I know what I'm doing. I'm in full control. I know how to get my happiness. Why are you telling me to live in a certain way? So because of this dense darkness of ignorance, people cannot see things as they are. They cannot see the reality. And Prabhupada mentions that lust is the symbol of ignorance. So when one is covered by ignorance, so ignorance gives rise to this lust. Because of ignorance, this lust arises, and our intelligence is influenced by lust. And that causes the spirit soul to acquire the false ego. And because of that false ego, we identify with the body. So there's that famous verse, Yasyatma buddhi kunapet vidhatuke swadhi kalatri vishu bhoma ijyadhi yatirtha buddhi salile na karhichit janeshu abhigneshu sa eva gokhara. So one is considered to be an ass or a cow if one identifies the body made of three elements as the self. Kapha, pitta, vayu. If you consider the body to be the self, or if you consider the byproducts of the body to be your kinsmen. So in other words, if you consider the body to be the self and anything in relationship to the body as ours, and if we consider the land of birth as worshipable, or if one goes to the place of pilgrimage simply to take a bath rather than to meet men of transcendental knowledge. So this is what happens when we are covered over by false ego. We accept the material body as a self. So this ignorance in the form of lust, it actually covers the real knowledge of the living entity. As Krishna mentions in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, this lust covers the true knowledge of the living entity. And this lust burns like fire and it's never satisfied. So this lust is residing in our senses, in our mind and our intelligence. These are the places where lust is residing. And through lust, our real knowledge that we are the servant of Krishna is fully covered over. And if you go outside this temple and ask someone, do you know who is Krishna? Of course, by the mercy of Srila Prabhupada and so much preaching has happened, so people know Krishna, they heard of Krishna. But generally, people don't know who is Krishna. They do not know Krishna's position. Neither do they know who they are. So this is the effect of lust. Everyone has forgotten Krishna. To such a degree that even if you say, you know, Krishna is God, they are like, huh? You know, what? So this is because of lust, which is covering our true knowledge. So originally, we were fully conscious of our true position as servants of Krishna. But because of being influenced by ignorance, we have forgotten that. And because of ignorance, it's amazing that because of ignorance, no matter whichever species of life one is situated in, they are fully happy in that species. So there's that example of once Indra was cursed by Brihaspati, and he was cursed to take the body of a hog. And then after some time, Brahma came and said, you know, Indra, you should, why in the body of a hog, come back to your position. And Indra said, no, actually I'm fully satisfied. I'm happy here with my piglets. I'm happy with my piglets, you know, lying down in the stool, in the gutter, I'm actually fully happy. So if you offer a hog some halwa or sweet rice, it will not eat it. The hog will reject that. So because of ignorance, the living entities are actually tasting hog-like happiness. And even if something superior is offered to them, they reject that. And out of ignorance, the living entity thinks that he or she is permanent in this world. And because they accept the body as a self and they think they are permanent, their situation is permanent, and they engage in all kinds of criminal acts for sense enjoyment. So that description is very nicely given in the third canto. Lord Kapila Dev describes to his mother Devahuti how the living entity, when he misidentifies with his body, he thinks that he's permanent and his goal in life is to fulfill the needs of his family. Of course, these days the family unit is also lacking. So it's the partner or ourselves. And as is mentioned, Nunam Pramate Kurute Vikarma, that because of identifying the body as a self, one engages in criminal acts of sense enjoyment. So then one is totally oblivious to the laws of nature and one ignores that. So in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna presents both the positive and the negative. So Krishna is not only presenting the problem, but Krishna is even presenting the solution. If we accuse someone with some fault, they become quite upset if we don't give the solution. But Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita is also giving the solution. Krishna is pointing out the problem, which is ignorance, and is also giving the solution. So Krishna says, Tesham Evanukam Partham, that I dwelling within their hearts, with the lamp of knowledge, I dispel the darkness which is born of ignorance. So in other words, one who is practicing Krishna consciousness, Krishna dispels the darkness of ignorance. So Krishna gives the process of devotional service by which we can dispel this darkness. And even the sages of Naimisharanya headed by Shaunaka Rishi, they put this question to Sudha Goswami, that now that Krishna has departed for his own abode, accompanied by knowledge and religion, so where are the principles of religion? Where will we find them? And then Sudha Goswami mentions that though Krishna has left, he has left behind the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the literary incarnation of Krishna. And that Srimad Bhagavatam can dispel this darkness of ignorance in the age of Kali. So this Srimad Bhagavatam is compared to the sun. So when the sun rises, we can see things as they are. At night, when if you go to the farm, it's pitch dark. You can't see anything. You can't even see your hand in front of you. Or you can't even see your nose. But when the sun rises, everything is illuminated and we can see things as they are. So if we simply pay heed to the Srimad Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, we can be awakened to a true position. And then this ignorance is dispelled. But in today's civilization, the modern education, the universities are simply centers of nescience, where this ignorance is, one is thrown deeper into ignorance. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that material knowledge makes one into an ass. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says. So, material knowledge is furthering ignorance because there is no development of good qualities in people. So, people are passing out of universities and colleges, but their character is terrible. So, and Prabhupada mentions that even a boy who is, materially speaking, is uneducated, but still he has control over his senses. And he won't go to the cinemas and nightclubs and pubs and clubs. And he has good qualities. But the material education, we study so much, come out of university, but still people are addicted to cigarettes, you know, clubbing, this and that, and so many sinful activities. So modern education is not actually producing any good qualities. It is actually furthering this ignorance. But of course, Arjuna's ignorance is different from our ignorance. It says that when Arjuna was seemingly polluted by ignorance, so because Arjuna is a pure devotee of Krishna as an eternal associate, he cannot be put into ignorance. He cannot be in ignorance, but he was put into ignorance by the will of Krishna. So when Arjun requested Krishna to draw the chariot between the two armies, when he saw the soldiers on the opposing side, he was inflicted by the bodily concept of life. And this was actually by Krishna's will, so that Krishna could enlighten him in the Bhagavad Gita for our benefit. So I'll stop here and see if there's any questions or comments. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for such a nice class. When we're describing Lord Brahma's creation, I couldn't quite hear, so please clarify. You're describing that the body of ignorance is generated by Lord Brahma and the yakshas and rakshasas embrace that form. Does that mean that that's how they appear, or please clarify.
Who appear? The yakshas and rakshasas.
Does that describe the manifestation of the yakshas and rakshasas?
Okay. I'm not sure about the manifestation of the rakshasas and yakshasas. I mentioned that they embrace that body. In other words, they embraced it and were affected by it. Yes.
You were telling about five types of ignorance. Can you give me the reference in my
opinion? Oh, okay. I'll have to check on Vedabase. I can tell you later.
Okay.
Yeah, it's in the third canto.
No worries.
Later chapters. Yes, Prabhu.
You were saying how Krishna
pretty much answered your own question.
Yes.
So the four Kumaras, we know, they are cursing Jay and Vijay. They wanted to have darshan of the Lord, and ordinarily they won't get angry, and ordinarily Jay and Vijay would not stop them. But somehow they were, by Krishna's will, they were put in a state of ignorance, polluted by ignorance, and then they cursed, you know. They cursed the Jay and Vijay.
You mean four Kumaras?
The four Kumaras, yeah. So it's mentioned that actually that was by the will of the Lord, because the Lord wanted to have a fight in the material world. His hands were itchy because Janmadi Asayataha, from Krishna everything comes. So Krishna can't fight in the spiritual world because all the devotees, if he has to fight, he has to come to the material world, and he won't fight with demons. So he'll fight with devotees. So therefore Jay and Vijay were cursed to take birth as demons. And in the same way, Krishna will speak to his devotee, and Krishna won't speak to a demon. So he put his devotee Arjuna into bewilderment, so as a means to speak to him. And so we see many of the pastimes when Parikshit Maharaj cursing was, ordinarily won't be inflicted by hunger and thirst, but Maharaj Parikshit was. So it's the leela of it's the will of the Lord, and also to teach us also a lesson. That's another reason also, because we are affected by ignorance and we act like that. So Krishna is trying to teach us.
If these are men of good qualification. And yet they manifest symptoms of
these are men of good qualification? You mean like the Kumaras?
Well, anger is considered to be a symptom of the light of ignorance. You mentioned that under the Mishra. Right? So, you know, we see, I think it can be a little bit discouraging because we see symptoms of ignorance even in great devotees. And so, if they're great, what is their greatness if they still manifest the symptoms of the ignorant? And then, therefore, what's hope is there for us? How does it?
Well, if you take the four Kumaras, they got angry because they were denied access to the Lord. And Prabhupada mentions that there's nothing wrong in that kind of anger because they actually wanted to see Krishna. Well, the thing which is good about them is that Krishna is the focus in their life. And sometimes even great souls, even though they manifest sometimes very lower qualities, but if the main thing is that they have to be surrendered to Krishna, and then all the other good qualities will eventually come about. It's my understanding. If that surrender to Krishna is there, and then naturally all these other good qualities will manifest. But of course, that Maya is by the will of the Lord, so.
So, what's the qualification?
What's his qualification?
What's the qualification that makes him great?
I guess they surrender to the Lord. And though even he heard the Bhagavad Gita, he was willing to take guidance from the Lord, and then he changed.
Well, I was thinking with your question, in when Mother Parvati is cursing Maharaj Pitaketan, Lord Shiva thereafter starts instructing her that Nirsinathana, this is a very dear devotee of the Lord, and he explained that this is a Vaishnava, that a devotee, although seemingly sometimes he speaks bad about someone as great as Lord Shiva, the devotee allows himself to be used and ridiculed by the Supreme Lord, so that the Lord himself is glorified by the humble action of Marshification, and at the same time Marshification is glorifying the Supreme Lord in terms of Lord Shiva and Mother Parvati, when he comes and pays his obeisances that yes, I will observe your curse. So my understanding that sometimes, you know, Krishna will seemingly embarrass a devotee or put them in a difficult circumstance like a Pandava, etc., but that their qualification is that they allow themselves to be used by Krishna.
Yeah.
But
keep doing service.
Yeah,
they keep doing their service. Even if, and interestingly, even it appears as if they're not doing service, but they still do their service. So, you know, Arjuna's in Maya, but he's still, his Maya is actually his service. Mm. That's how he accepts it. So even a devotee is prepared to be in ignorance to serve Krishna. But he's a servant. He maintains his service attitude. And that's what makes him a devotee. That's his greatest, even arguably, his greatest qualification, is that he'll continue to do service even in my house. Whereas we in my house can do service.
That's a good point. Even when the spiritual master
would tell this to
Sasana
and
Yeah, yeah.
And then he does this astrology when you're not talking properly.
Yes.
So, from my own experience, like, I've been told at least that's the job of the spiritual master to chastise you when you're not, you know,
doing
it properly. And then sometimes you give him a position of a leadership or, you know, position of a president or head of a department to check on us and make sure we're doing the properly. So, one less, you know, people who see probably, you know, I mean, just tired and misunderstand that. But that's the job of the superiors to check on us and chastise us to so that we can improve.
That's right.
And it's like, you know, it's a blessing in disguise, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. So anger is a in Krishna consciousness, anger has its utility, so anger can be used. So if you have to correct someone, it can be used. Prabhupada would use anger. So Prabhupada would be angry sometimes, but the next moment he would be composed. So he won't get carried away by it. It's interesting, he says, praise in public, chastise in private. So that's the principle. Sometimes the tendency can be to chastise in public, that can be also an exhibition of false ego. Not saying for the spiritual master, but for ourselves, yeah.
I think about the Santa, what you mentioned, that the one who glorified me is my enemy, and the one who criticized me, fast forwarding, is my friend.
Yeah. Yes, but. As Prabhu mentioned that his being in Maya is to, that's a service. So he's being in Maya so that he can be instructed. So he's doing that as a service. So Bhagavad Gita can be spoken for our benefit.
Then why does Krishna will that I'm in Maya?
Well, Krishna didn't will we are in Maya. That's because of our own desire. Because we desire to enjoy separately from Krishna. And then we are actually put here. It's mentioned in the prayers of the fortunate living entity in the womb that when he realizes that he's servant of Krishna, when his consciousness is awakened, he mentions that I cannot pay my debt to you, my Lord, but all I can do is express my gratitude with folded hands. In other words, the Lord is always making so many arrangements to take us out of Maya. And the reason we came is out of our own will. So it is Krishna's will to create the material world, but it's not his desire. His desire is to keep us in the spiritual world, but because of our stubborn desire, then it's his will to create the material world and put us there. But it's not his desire.
You explained it before. His desire was to create the material world. Jivas.
A chance to.
A chance.
Yeah.
So that's his will.
That's right. It's his will. It's not his desire.
But it's our will that we were in England.
That's right, yeah.
His will that we get out, ours is to stay. Turn up the light.
Yeah, because it's very clearly mentioned in the translation when Arjuna was seemingly polluted by ignorance. That word is used seemingly. So ours is, for us, that seemingly is not there. We are actually polluted by ignorance, and we are the cause for it.
Possible that we could be attracted by something else if we were already there.
how we attracted free will. Because of our free will, we want to try something else, we want to see something else. We actually mentioned that we want to take his position. So out of free will.
And keep in mind that we're also all attracted in the spiritual world as a trap. Whereas, you know, the residents of Vaikuntha all have four arms and all as well endowed as Vishnu, as powerful. So when you're as powerful as God, then the tendency, the trick is, or the trap is to think, oh, I'm not as good as God. Let me enjoy it.
It's actually the desire to take Krishna's position, to be like Krishna, because that hate that comes, I want to be like Krishna, and so material world is a place where we can try to be like Krishna. So Krishna says, Bhoktaram Vyagatapasam Sarvaloka Meshwam Suridam Sarvabhutanam Gyatvamam Shantimuchati. Krishna says, all sacrifices are meant for me, I'm the lord of all planets and I'm the best friend of everyone. So in the material world, we take that position. Everything should be done for me. I'm the proprietor, at least of something. And then I'm the friend of other living entities because I do charity and so many other things. So it's just basically wanting that. We're wanting that position because of misuse of free will. It's pretty simple. Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada.